Hello and welcome to the Echo Chamber podcast. My name is Tony Groves, and today we are back talking about the migrant experience and about the entire last few weeks of how things have been felt very much like 2004. Martin, you remember 2004 because you were only in your 40s back then and your mind was working better.
I remember 1984, and we're closer to that than we are 2004.
What is it? Peace is love. War is peace.
War is peace.
Yeah. Just quick reminder to listeners: we have our actual Christmas party is this Friday evening, and it sounds like it's going to be chaos because the ladies are running roughshod in the WhatsApp about some sort of musical bingo and spot prizes, and there's a threat that the worst. The worst guesses get a signed picture of me with my top off. So you want to at least lift the standard, guys. If you're interested, patreon.com/tortoiseshack. And while you're there, please do sign up. It really helps us across the Tortoise Shack continue to produce the podcast that tens of thousands of you are listening to. Anyway, enough self-praise. We're delighted to be rejoined on the line by CEO of NASC Ireland, Fiona Finn. Fiona, how are things?
Good, Tony. Thank you. And Martin, how are you? Thanks for having me on today.
Not at all. Look, the last time we had you on, you were on the police podcast and you made a brilliant contribution to Maho's story. And yeah, first of all, thank you for that. But it just shows you the importance of the work of something like NASC actually do in terms of giving that space for the migrant voice and experience in Ireland. And, you know, again, here's a plug to people want to know, go to naskireland.org because, you know, there are ways we can all get involved and ways we can get better. I suppose the main thing we want to talk about today, though, is the day report.
Okay.
Do you want to give our listeners a quick idea of what has been published and what that actually potentially means?
So it was actually December last year. The Catherine Day report was convened. It was before the election and before we had the commitment in the programme for government to abolish direct provision. And it was convened to, and it was chaired by Dr. Catherine Day, and she's the former Secretary General of the European Commission. And on that group was ourselves, Bolani Mafako from MASI, Nick Henderson from the Refugee Council, members of the department, senior officials from the Department of Justice, and sort of retired officials then from various government departments across social protection, revenue, right across the spectrum. And it was convened to look at the current system of direct provision and to establish really what was a permanent system. And I think at the start, you know, we were a bit sceptical because NASC had sat on the McMahon working group, and the terms of reference in the McMahon working group were very limited. So it was never part of McMahon to end direct provision, but we were just looking at reforms. And as we know, an awful lot of the reforms didn't happen. But the terms of reference of this group were a lot broader. And the way the chair, Catherine Day, interpreted and came to the conclusion very quickly was that direct provision was not fit for purpose. And what needed to happen was we needed to there was a need for a new and what she'd always termed was a permanent system, so that people coming to Ireland to seek protection should no longer be a sort of an add-on. You know what I mean? They needed to be part of our policy across a number of areas. So it was around the creation of a new permanent system for people who are seeking protection in Ireland and how we can best protect their rights and their dignity. And I think the core of that then was looking at the housing. So obviously how we house asylum seekers while they're in Ireland. It didn't just look at the housing, it looked at the whole system as a whole. So basically it's almost like a jigsaw puzzle. So if your refugee determination process isn't functioning properly, then obviously your reception process isn't functioning properly. So in the report, we concluded and we looked at all the options that were available, and we concluded that direct provision had to end, that the priority was no more congregated settings, no more congregated living, and asylum seekers were to live in the community. So there was very broad agreement on that across the board. So obviously, direct provision, it's almost now like an institution. You know what I mean? It's a 20-year-old institution It's actually 21. It's 21 years old on the 10th of December. So it's around how do we dismantle that institution? So we've came up with a new model of housing people in direct provision. So firstly, all asylum applications need to be concluded within a fixed period of time. So that's 6 months for your first instance decision, and then a further 6 months if you have to go to appeal. And the proposal is that asylum seekers will be housed for an initial 3 month period in a reception centre. So when they arrive into the country first, they'll be housed in a reception centre for a 3 month period. And this reception centre needs to be state owned. So no...
Not for profit.
It's not for profit. So within this reception centre then, all the supports are to be front loaded for asylum seekers. So their early legal advice, assistance with the application, letting them, you know, informing people how the process actually works, because many people don't know where they are in the system or how the process actually works. Provision of healthcare, provision of vulnerability assessment, provision of a medical card. So after, and then obviously special supports, then specific supports for children who have coming into the country, kind of like almost like an orientation program, letting them know how the school education system works, all of that. And then after that initial 3 month process, then asylum seekers will be granted the right to work. So they'll be leaving the initial reception center, moving into the community with the right to work, and then living in the community. A key part of that is the establishment of what's kind of called a housing, what was called a housing allocations or a housing matching body. Mm. So this matching body would match families with accommodation in the community. And then that really what it's doing is it's putting the onus on local authorities to secure accommodation for protection applicants. Now, the this accommodation is said to be it's new capacity. It's not looking at additional capacity. It's sitting outside the housing allocations policy because the housing is temporary in nature, because it's just for the period while the asylum application has been processed. And each local authority will have a separate funding scheme to enable the local authority to provide this accommodation for protection applicants while they're living in the community. Local authorities will be given 2.5 years to secure this additional stock. It is up to the local authority what housing model they choose. So they could choose self-build, they could use private rented sector,
AHPs, whatever range
of options is open to them. And the system is designed to deal with about 3,500 people. Now, that's a lot less. It's not 3,500 housing units because almost 40% of people seeking protection in Ireland are part of a family unit. Single people would share accommodation. But again, when we're talking about shared accommodation, it's like a house share. So, but each asylum applicant would have their own bedroom and would have their own space. And the allocations then to local authorities is going to be predetermined. So local authorities will know in advance how many, what allocation of housing they need to provide on an annual basis for protection applicants. And then while protection applicants are living in the community, they need to be provided with the supports. So it's not that people are going to be living in the community and it's like, okay, off you go. So any additional supports that people are to be provided with are going to be done in the local community through the local authority. And the local authority can either ask a local NGO or community group or community and voluntary group to provide those supports. But I suppose at the heart and at the core of it is that A, we need to start planning for protection applicants coming into the country because they have been coming for the last 25 years. This is not going to stop. And we have to look at it and it has to form part of our housing policy. It can no longer be, oh, you know, 2,000 asylum seekers have arrived in Ireland this year. How are we going to house them? What are we going to do?
Just want to come in on that, if you don't mind, because it's nearly 3.5 years ago we spoke to Lorcan Sturr, the housing professor, on this podcast. And he's actually on the Irish Refugee Council.
Yeah.
And he has said all along that... that this was the housing issue should be in the Department of Housing, and it should, you know, for it, it's the responsibility of the state to make provision there, where whether it's via a model such as Housing First or whatever other models we want to operate, that's where it should live, because that is where housing is a human right, and exactly. it matches that. You have, though, heard some pushback, and it's not exactly I would call it not exactly the most well-informed pushback in terms of the possibility, and some of it is quite can be taken to be a bit divisive.
I agree. So as part of the deliberations of the group, right, we were very careful to engage with all the bodies that would be affected by the changes that were being proposed. So the International Protection Office were consulted, the Refugee Appeals Tribunal were consulted, and the Department of Housing were consulted. And the initial meeting with the Department of Housing was a difficult meeting, and it was quite challenging, and they raised a number of issues. And that happened maybe in June. So then the group came back, and we looked at the proposals again, and we kind of looked at, okay, you know, there's some merit in what they were saying. Purview of councillors, and that could get very kind of difficult and tricky when you're looking at the housing of protection applicants in the community. So then we looked at those, and then we kind of looked at the recommendations, and we kind of thought, okay, so a way to address this is that the funding for protection applicants be ring fenced. So it sits outside housing allocations policy. It's a set amount every year that local authorities get. And then we broadened it out that the housing model that people can choose could be, it's up to the local authority. And if local authorities do decide to go to the private rented market, because unfortunately that's the reality of the world that we're living in now at the moment, there was a recommendation in there that protection applicants be given a HAP type payment. It's not HAP, but the payment that they would be given would be modelled on HAP, and then the social welfare that they would be given when they're living in the community would be the equivalent of the social welfare allowances of Irish people who are living in the community. Then we met again with the housing department, and when we went through our new thoughts on the housing model chosen, they seemed really, you know, quite comfortable with it. And I think the fact that it was 2.5 years to get there, and I know 2.5 years is a very long time for someone who's living in direct provision, I get it, like, you know, they had some kind of degree of comfort in that, and the fact that it would be, you know, not part of their housing allocations policy, so it doesn't interfere with the social housing policy. And then it was really surprising when in September, when we had finished our deliberations, the group received a 15-page thesis almost on why this would not work. And basically what's underlying it is that, you know, there is no place for the housing of protection applicants. It doesn't sit, and it shouldn't sit within the housing department. They argued that they'd have to provide housing for over 7,000. They have to provide over 7,000 housing units, which again is incorrect. They also argued that housing people in the community would end up, kind of people would be housed and in the housing stock that they would have allocated for vulnerable people and for other people who had been on the social housing list for 15 years. Again, none of that was correct. And then they kind of came to the conclusion that the group should turn and look at housing homeless hubs as a potential model, or we should look at state-build clustered living for protection applicants. And I think we looked at that, and we concluded that homeless hubs are wholly unsuitable for everybody, and that state-owned clustered living read to us like DP light. And from that perspective, I mean, it was almost like as if you were dressing direct provision up in a different language.
Making it kinder was some of the phrases that we've heard.
Taking the meanness out of it and making it kinder. And then they cited the competence of the Department of Justice in the delivery of housing by saying that they provide housing for people in the Defence Forces, and they provide housing for guards when they're training in Tullamore. And you're kind of thinking, well, if that's their expertise, then I think, you know, that doesn't sound like a very valid argument.
They seem dead set against ending direct provision as it exists at the moment. That seems to be their forte. They don't want it to end as it is. They certainly don't want the responsibility of having it under their remit.
Yeah.
That's very clear. How do you get around them? How do you change that mindset?
I mean, that's a hard one. It's really difficult. I mean, we were heartened last week when the Deputy Joe O'Brien. He's the Minister for State for Charities and Community, I think. So he came out very strongly against the Housing Department's submission, and he came out publicly. And I think that, again, I think that for us was very important because it's within the government. I think what's key for us is that the next step now that the government are going to take in the, in I suppose, looking at how we're going to end our provision, is going to appear in the white paper. So at the moment, they're developing a white paper. So I suppose what we would like to urge everybody or anybody who has any interest in ending direct provision is we have an opportunity to do it now. It's going, what, so the new model, for want of a better word, is going to be in the white paper. So we would urge everybody to contact their TD and make sure that the core recommendations of the day report, i.e. bottom line, living in the community, are and not DP light, make their way into the white paper. Because I think it would be absolutely devastating for asylum seekers. They have been promised time and time and time and time again. You know, McMahon, yes, things are going to get better. Oh, we have the DEA report. Yes, things are going to get better. And now we have the white paper. And I think it would be cruel in the extreme to turn around and say, well, we're just now going to tinker around the edges if we have to have.
OK, you've mentioned how Joe O'Brien, who's a member of government and kind of a bit of a dissenter, he has the distinction of being one of only two TDs of member of government who voted against the government and is a lifelong campaigner for human rights issues. So that's a positive. Roderick O'Gorman said all the right things before he sat his arse in the chair as minister. I know he's coming under huge pressure, but we have seen some, you know, positive developments potentially. Like we've seen the potential for permits for up to 17,000 people who are undocumented. There are, but again, we don't want tinkering at the edges here. We need an end to direct provision. So to take that forward, if you look at campaigns that have been successful over the last few months, it has been the likes where your TD received 400 emails, you know, and you do those things. So this can be done. The back to Department of Housing issue, they use the term of displacement. And then that reminded me also of the Justice Minister Helen McEntee speaking in the Shannon last week, and she used that the immigration thing about a causing pressure on our health service, and we've seen in our health service people are on the front line working and then going back to sleep in their direct provision centre. How must people feel?
And we've also seen healthcare workers in direct provision receiving intentions to deport, which is absolutely criminal. And that's another key recommendation in Day, is the immediate granting of residency permission for all healthcare workers who are in direct provision in recognition of the work that they have been done. And there was two women came forward a couple of weeks ago and were interviewed about how they felt. I mean, obviously they feel demoralized and dehumanized, and it's, you know, I think it's unforgivable, really, to turn around and say, on one hand, we're going to clap our healthcare workers, and, you know, they're great, and they're, you know, they're our heroes. And then at the other hand, you're going to, oh, well, actually, sorry, like, you know, you can't stay here now. Thank you very much. You know, it's devastating stuff. Like.
It does show a split in the thinking between what they say and what they do. I mean, when you can have you have the housing department saying, let justice do it. And then you have the Minister for Justice basically undermining refugees and immigrants who come into this country and saying that they are a burden on our health service. And the fact is that without them, we wouldn't have a health service. Yeah. It simply wouldn't exist. Yeah. It would be non-functional. How do you square that circle? How do you get the people in power to see that what they're doing is structural violence towards refugees and immigrants?
Yeah, I think it's hard, but I do think politicians will only listen, really, if they get a sense that they're from the public, that their moral compass is off, or that what they're doing is completely is unacceptable. And I think one of the key things that has sort of changed the political attitude to, say, direct provision was the fact that or most people in Ireland, an awful lot of voters now really care about direct provision. Do you know what I mean? Like for years and years and years, it really wasn't in the kind of public perception. Do you know what I mean? People kind of, they knew what happened. And you had the referendum in 2004, which was hugely damaging and a massive setback for years and years and years. But when you have that kind of, there's ordinary members of the public coming out, supporting refugees and asylum seekers who are living in DP and absolutely and utterly opposed to direct provision. I mean, there is an acceptance now that direct provision is not acceptable, and it's taken 20 years to get there. I think it is only by keeping that kind of level of pressure up. Because, I mean, at the end of the day, if there's no votes in it, you know, politicians aren't going to do it in the main, you know. It's not... It's not in their interest.
If it hurts their vote, it will hurt. And it will actually make them change. But I will say one other thing that we can't lose sight of, because we haven't said it here. It's also, we have to remove the profit motive.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, I mean, it's making money from human misery is what it is.
It's an industry, like. It's a huge industry. That's what it is. And I think that has absolutely, I think that's what ended up creating the kind of institutional piece.
Well, I just want listeners to understand about the idea that we say, if we said make direct provision kinder by reducing it to homeless hubs, the price of Mel Reynolds' figures put the cost of putting a family, which is generally could be a one parent family, could be whatever, is about €69,500 a year.
Wow.
A year. And then you factor the average stays about 30 months. Okay. So for $15,000 more, we can build a 3-bed house according to the government's own report. Yeah. So if you're telling me that it even makes financial sense, well, then you're just being daft. You're being actually needlessly cruel for the sake of $15,000. It just doesn't make any sense.
And like in the context of the report, we got costings across all the different models, right? And so we looked at the current model, the way it is now. And we looked at the proposed model, that is housing in the community. We put into that costing HAP payment, the HAP equivalent, the homeless HAP, and equivalent social welfare in comparison to the 38.80 that people are currently receiving, and the restoration of child benefit for children. And it came out at €39.5 million cheaper than what we currently have. Now, you know, I don't like talking about things in financial costs, but I mean, I do think...
Neither do I, but some people want to hear that.
Do you know what I mean? That it is actually going to be cheaper for the state. And that is even taking the human cost out of it. So if you have people who are living in the community, if you have people who are working, if you have people who are part of the community, you have that whole kind of enriching of our communities and people being integrated at a very early stage. And you know what I mean? It's just...
quicker to become net contributors in terms of if you want to talk brass taxes.
Look at it in that context, you know what I mean? It's really important that we stop with this kind of paternalistic attitude that we have towards it. You know what I mean? Like, we have to put them over there and they're vulnerable. And yes, some are vulnerable, but these are people with agency, education. You know what I mean? They're incredibly resilient. And I think it's that paternalistic attitude that the state has always had towards what it perceives as vulnerable groups in society. You know, they have to be minded.
There's an othering in it as well. They are something other than us. It may come in cheaper, but there's very little profit margin for it to come in cheaper. And I think that's more the driving force that keeps direct provision where it is at the moment. I think the fact that it is a for-profit model is what has allowed it to exist. If it was a non-for-profit model, there are cheaper ways to do it. There are cheaper ways to do it. Yeah. So it's the profit model we have to take out of it. Then it only makes sense to do it the right way.
Yeah, it does. Absolutely. There's no other way to do it, like, you know.
Fiona,
but, I mean, I do think, though, that sometimes when you think about it, like, so if we are talking about housing people in the community, and if we are, which may be the reality if this comes to pass, that, you know, people will be paying rent. So there is that profit element in there, in a sense. But
absolutely, yeah.
But there's a difference because so people are paying the rent for a house, not a room rate, a bed rate per night, which is a high minimum high.
Sorry, Fiona, you broke up there for 2 seconds.
Yes. Oh, sorry.
You said it's not a room rate, if you wouldn't mind just
so, repeating. Yeah, it's not a room rate. So the current model is how they cost it is what they get paid per bed per night. Mm. And it's whether or not that bed space is occupied or not. So they currently put the cost at about 35 to 40 euros a night. And that's just for bed and accommodation, or like bed and food.
Yeah.
And like, even if you look at the provision of, there are shops in centres, right? So we're centres that have cooking in them. But again, like, you know, the shops are run by the centre managers. So obviously they're going to make a profit on the food that they sell. Do you know what I mean? And they have a point system. And again, that is really mean. Why not give people money so they can go to whatever their local Tesco or Lidl or Aldi or wherever they want to go to buy their food rather than being limited to what's in the shop? So at every hand's turn, DP owners are making a profit, and they've been facilitated to make profits, you know, and that's the driver of the current system.
Can I ask, sorry, Martin, I know you want to, but I want to ask one question about the work of NASC themselves. You're about family reunification. Some of the pushback I've heard from this has actually been that we'll create a pull factor if we make this. How do you know? Again, I suppose it is about sharing those stories and making sure people know that this is, you know, this removing that othering, as Martin put it. But you know, the idea of family reunification—that is protect. That's a human right protected internationally. Yeah. And you make the point that direct provision is 21 years old on, like, in 2 days' time, and which happens to be the same day as the International Day of Human Rights. You know, I mean, we have to get serious about this, and it has to be in that white paper that we're. You know, I know that I see Amnesty have a campaign of name the date. You know, let's make sure let's have the finish date. There it is, and that's the date it's going to end. Yeah. But in terms of the work that NASC are doing, you guys have some really good stories of people in the community.
And we have.
You know, if people, you know, if we could see that, I mean, we can lift that stigma.
Yeah, and come. I absolutely agree. And I think again, like, there's been a number of consultations around. Huge amount of consultations around ending DP. Mm. And people that we work with that are in the protection process are saying to us now, like, just don't ask us anymore. Do you know? You know what the problems are. You know what the issues are. This is not new or news to anybody, you know. And I think it is. And it's about getting those stories out, but it's about getting them out in the voice of the people who are impacted by it. And I think a big misconception around family reunification is that it's actually a key driver for integration, because people cannot survive, no matter what, you know what I mean? You could have the most luxurious accommodation in the whole entire world, but if you're thinking about your daughter or your mom or your father who's left behind in Syria, people can't function. And by having, I suppose, kind of broader and more inclusive family units, you then have the situation where grandparents can care for children. So parents can go to work and they can go to college. You know what I mean? And the family unit is intact. And it's, I suppose, like, the reality of refugee lives are very different to our kind of Western, you know, mum, dad, two children kind of perception. Do you know what I mean? They're much broader. And they tend to live in much broader family units. And I think by destroying, and I think by moving the right to family, reducing the right to family reunification, it's just destroying that. And it's destroying the lives of a lot of refugees. Because they can't move on. They can't get on with life. Like, you know, they'll say to us that they've left their heart behind. They're just existing. They're surviving. They're not living. And there's a very big difference between the two. Like,
We haven't at all spoken about the impact of COVID on the direct provision. And it has been shown that the setup of direct provision as it is at the moment has left people extremely vulnerable to infection within these centres. that alone should be a cause for concern for the government, and enough of a reason to say these congregated settings are not the best places to be. Why do you think, even with that knowledge, that government is slow to move this forward?
I think they are going to move it forward. Like, I think a lot will be in the white paper. I do think that they probably think it's more complicated than it is. Do you know what I mean? And I do think it's become very political, and it will be politicized. People have to be ambitious, and there has to be a degree of bravery. And I think it has to happen between government departments. This kind of silo thinking is not going to work anymore. It's not just a thing for the Department of Justice over there, you know? And I suppose one of the kind of more positive things around the pandemic, if there were anything positive, was that government departments had to come together, even in the context of people in direct provision, to protect the health of people in direct provision. So public health had to come together with the Department of Justice, had to come together with the local social inclusion unit. And it was that effective working together. It helped to, I wouldn't say, assist people who were living in direct provision over COVID-19. But I think COVID-19 has shown us, it has exposed the fault lines of what institutionalized living actually is, and how detrimental it is to the health and well-being of people, because they could not self-isolate, they couldn't social distance, sharing canteens, sharing bathrooms. And what was happening at the height of the pandemic was that infection rate was just, it was kind of spiraling, and it was going around and around and around and around, and it was going through centres. And you had people who were working in meat packing factories, who were working in extremely dangerous, high risk and contaminated settings, moving into direct provision. So I think there is a realisation there, but whether or not the urgency of ending direct provision that emerged over the pandemic is going to be sustained is a whole other question. Even in our kind of trying to kind of engage politically around the Day Report, it's actually been a lot more challenging than we had thought. You know what I mean? So a lot of people aren't really that interested in talking to us or Massey or the Refugee Council about the implementation of the day. And I think that is kind of worrying, that is concerning. So it's kind of, maybe as a political issue, maybe there's a feeling there that it's maybe slightly gone off the boil for them. You know what I mean? And I think that for us is very concerning. Like, it's to try and, we need to keep that momentum up, like, you know.
So the call is actually, and it's quite easy for listeners, it's you can go to naskireland.org, and there's a /take action. And the first thing you'll see is around direct provision, and you can make your voice heard. And that is simple. This is what we're asking. We're not asking you for money. We're not asking you, well, we always ask you for money on this podcast, but you know, we're not asking you for money right now. We're asking you to do something to help someone else who maybe doesn't have that opportunity to do that. So it's naskireland.org /take action. You'll find it there under the support banner anyway. But please, just make it relevant. Make them sit up and pay attention, because we've only got a few days before this white paper is. It's due before the doll breaks for Christmas.
Yeah, apparently we can't be in 20. You know, we can't be in the same situation again. Asylum seekers, don't mind us. Asylum seekers can't be in the same situation again. 20 years on, thinking here we are again.
And I think it's worth mentioning that one of the vaccines that's out there, it was the son of a Romanian immigrant. Yeah. So, and I think it's well worth pointing out.
It is.
So Fiona Finn from NASCAR. And look, we're going to leave it there for today, okay. But we really appreciate the time, and we appreciate the work that you guys do. As you know, the listeners know what to do. The link is on the podcast, guys. So take your phone out of your pocket and click on the link, and you'll be able to make your voice heard. Let your TD know as well. Definitely. Please. If you tweet them, if you email them, get at them. And that's the only
very
way.
Very simple, implement day.
Tony and Martin, Martin and Tony, speaking to interesting people only. It's the Echo Chamber podcast. Subscribe now on Patreon.